afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. Pape Machinery is located up at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, just off I-5. Go up and see them if you need a tractor, you need an implement, you need your tractor fixed, need parts, they do it all up there. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. So what's new and exciting?
Not a great question for me today.
No.
Let's see. Tell us a little bit about our guest, Bill.
Our guest today is Dr. Peter Pry. And our Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and we're going to talk about Taiwan and what's happening over there. China's making a move, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens, because I'm not sure we're really in a position to do much about anything over there right now, but we're going to find out. Dr. Pry, how are you doing today?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm talking to you from a beach on Boca Raton, pavilion overlooking beautiful Boca Raton, Florida, watching people play football out there in the sand.
Oh, man, I'm jealous.
Well, you know, that's my last day here, that I have to head back to Virginia.
Well, thanks for taking time to be on the radio today. That must have been a tough choice.
Oh, not at all. I always love to listen to the incredible humor of Aaron Ryan and yourself.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
You know, and besides, I'll probably be talking to you a lot from here, because I bought a home down in this area. I had one a couple of years ago.
Oh, wow!
But now that Florida is one of the last free states, you know, I want you to be here. Almost nobody wears masks. It's almost like it was before COVID.
Yeah.
Almost like real life.
Yeah, Florida's kind of getting it figured out. I wish the rest of the country would move on as well, but soon enough.
Your home state of Virginia's gone kind of crazy.
Yes, it is. And I'm going to keep my Virginia home, but, and probably go back and forth, but I'm going to switch my citizenship to being a Floridian, which is voting with my feet like everybody else in the country.
There you go.
Enjoying the land of the free down here. The topic today is Taiwan, and it's beyond Taiwan. It's also the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, because we're only a few days away. October 16th is usually given as the anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It'll be the 59th anniversary, almost 60 years since the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, and which many people regard as the closest we ever came to a nuclear war. Although that isn't true, there was at least one incident that was closer in 1995, but that can be the topic for. In fact, there were a couple of incidents that were probably closer, but that can be the topic for another time. The Cuban Missile Crisis always looms large, though, because it favors the Democratic Party. You know, the myth of JFK backing down the Russians, you know, is one of their favorite, is one of the few areas wherein they are interested in talking about nuclear crises and nuclear matters, because it's a big plus up for the Democrat Party, and Kennedy does deserve credit for what happened in Cuba, not only because of his leap.
Uh-oh.
I think a wave got him.
There's a lot of quietness all at once.
I hear the beach. We're going to have to try to make that connection again.
So much for the land of the free, huh?
Yeah.
Apparently the land of the free has been silenced. Momentarily.
I don't know. When he talks about the Cuban Missile Crisis, I know there's a lot of folks out there that probably aren't real familiar with that, but it is part of our history, and it is probably the closest we've come to a nuclear exchange. As a lot of folks know, Russia backed the Castro regime and installed nuclear missiles in Cuba aimed at the United States, which gave them a huge first strike capability. And Kennedy was able to back them down and get them to pull those missiles out of Cuba. I think a lot of that was due to the fact that Russia really wasn't in a position to get in a shooting war with the United States at that time. We had them outnumbered with our nuclear capability like 10 to 1 at that time, and they knew it. And plus, Cuba was so far away from Russia, they weren't really in a position to deploy across the ocean like that. So they did back down, and we averted a disaster. And now we're sitting here watching all this happen with Taiwan, and the similarities are kind of spooky. Now we're an ocean away. We're outnumbered tactically by the Chinese. And are we really in a position to do anything if China does decide to hit Taiwan? I mean, it wouldn't be easy for them, but they certainly have.
There you are.
I was doing my best Dr. Pry right there, and I was.
He was channeling your article. We should tell people that's posted on here. The Taiwan nuclear powder keg, a new Cuban missile crisis.
Yep.
And so that's on the page for today, which is October 10th.
Can you hear me all right?
Yep. We got you now.
Okay. Sorry, I cut out there. I don't know. I cannot account for it. Because I could hear you perfectly well.
Oh, it's always fun when that happens, and we're going hello.
Hello.
Yeah, and we won't even say the "Can you hear me now?" thing, because that guy just got way too annoying. It used to be fun, but he ruined it.
So, how'd I do? China is now a looming threat. Where do we stand right now?
Well, let me go back to because what I'm trying to do is talk about lessons learned from the Cuban Missile Crisis that may be applicable to the looming confrontation with China over Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lessons that are applicable and some that may not be. But the bottom line is that we're in big trouble where China is concerned. Because all of the factors that favored us during the Cuban Missile Crisis now favor China when it comes to Taiwan. Except that it favors them in space. They're in an even stronger position than we were during the Cuban Missile Crisis. To my knowledge, I'm really the only one who's tried to draw parallels between the situation with Cuba and the United States and the situation between Taiwan and China. And yet, there are enormous parallels between the two. You know, back in 1962, you know, communist Cuba was too weak to defend itself against the United States, and it required a superpower friend, and that was the Soviet Union, you know. Today, Taiwan is too weak to defend itself, and it requires a superpower friend, and that's the United States. And in both cases, you know, the Soviet Union back in 1962 wasn't strong enough with conventional forces, Navy, Air Force, for example, or ground forces, to be able to defend Cuba. It was too far away. It was on the edge of the Soviet Union's power projection capabilities. And so they defended Cuba by extended nuclear deterrence. You know, the fact that they were a nuclear power, they relied upon that to try to extend their nuclear umbrella over Cuba. And where Taiwan is concerned today, you know, Taiwan is, now this wasn't the case for many years, you know, because China for decades has been, you know, too weak militarily to project its forces across the straits to invade Taiwan, but that situation has changed. You know, and now Taiwan, relative to Chinese military power, you know, is at the very edge of our ability to project power. You know, and so really, it's our nuclear deterrent that is the chief thing that would protect Taiwan. The situation has gotten so much worse because basically as recently as this summer, we found the Chinese building up their nuclear arsenal. Can you still hear me? Am I?
No, we got you loud and clear.
Make sure we didn't.
You're not talking to yourself.
Right. You know, we've seen the Chinese building first 150, then 200, then 250, then 350, and now up to 400 ICBM silos that we know of, probably for their DS-41 ICBM, which, as we've talked about before in your show, is a 10 warhead ICBM. That can give them 4,000 strategic nuclear weapons that can reach the U.S. homeland, you know, on just that one missile system when it's completed. And they're rushing to completion. It'll be completed in several years. So in just a few years, they'll have 4,000 weapons. That's enormously significant. You know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had started off about how the Cuban Missile Crisis is the Democrat Party's favorite nuclear crisis. Really the only one they talk about. You know, because Kennedy prevailed and they see that as a big win for the Democrats. But they never talk about the fact that the reason Kennedy prevailed is that he was alarmed about a missile gap. He ran for president, and one of the things he was elected on was that he was going to close the alleged missile gap with the Soviet Union. You know, the Soviets had beat us to building long-range missiles. They had demonstrated an intercontinental capability by orbiting Sputnik. By the way, I remember when I was a little kid visiting my grandmother in Rhode Island, and everybody was standing outside at night, and we could actually see Sputnik, you know, cross the sky overhead. Can you imagine what, for Americans, how terrifying that must have been, you know, that we could actually see the evidence of this artificial satellite, you know, passing over our head?
Yeah.
And we had not orbited satellites. The United States didn't have the capability yet. That was a technological. We were used to being ahead of everybody in technology, and here was this incredible capability. You know, that was maybe 5 years before the Cuban Missile Crisis, all right? And we were engaged in the so-called space race, which was really a race for military superiority also. And we were losing. We were losing that race. So the idea of the Russians being ahead of us in long-range intercontinental missiles was a terrifying prospect. And Kennedy launched a crash program to build ICBMs. You know, first the Atlas, you know, then the Minuteman I, then the Minuteman II. But the Minuteman, by the time we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had outproduced the Soviets in ICBMs. We had a 5-to-1 advantage in ICBMs. And, of course, we had a vastly superior long-range strategic bomber force. You know, a huge advantage in strategic bombers. And the Democrats always forget that it wasn't Kennedy's courage and leadership, you know, that defeated the Soviet Union during the Cuban Missile Crisis. There were material military reasons he won that. He had prepared for some kind of a crisis by building up our nuclear deterrent. And it was the 5-to-1 advantage in ICBMs that made them back off. It was the huge advantage in strategic bombers that made them back off. It was an object lesson at the very beginning of the nuclear arms race that superiority matters a lot. The superiority can make the difference between nuclear war and peace. And it made the difference, you know, because it was a very close call. You know, the Soviets had all their prestige on the line here. Don't forget, Cuba was symbolically important to the Soviet Union because Fidel Castro's revolution appeared to be a victory for the communist system. In fact, it was a victory for the communist system. The people had thrown off the yoke of capitalism and embraced communism in America's own backyard. In America's own backyard. Don't forget, we had American corporations were very heavily invested in Cuba. It was a favorite tourist site and everything. You know, it should have been a shining example for the third world of the virtues of free enterprise. So this was an enormous symbolically important win in the ideological struggle, you know, during the early Cold War.
Let's stop right there for just a second. We'll take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. It is October 10th, 2021. You can find everything about the show at wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start.
I love that song. Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, what a classic group. So, sorry for that brief interruption. Continue on.
Oh, not at all.
Back to Cuba.
Okay, yeah, so back to Cuba. So, you know, everything seemed to be on the line between the superpowers in 1962. You know, they were struggling for the minds of the whole world, free world. You know, Soviet communism claimed it was superior to free enterprise, and they seem to be demonstrating that by Sputnik, by their being ahead of us in the missile race, and now Cuba had gone communist and thrown off and rejected our system. So they had an enormous incentive to protect Cuba and preserve that revolution. We had a very powerful and compelling interest in overthrowing the Cuban government as well. You know, it represented an intrusion on our hemisphere. It was a violation of the Monroe Doctrine, you know, where we had pledged that we were going to keep foreign powers out of our hemisphere. But at the same time, the United States was extremely sensitive to the idea that we were being accused by the communists of being an imperialist system, you know, that we were crushing freedom movements in the third world, that we would not let third world countries have self-determination. And so we couldn't just send the Marines in and overthrow Castro without hurting ourselves and losing the ideological argument with the Soviet Union, or at least that's what our State Department believed. Personally, I think we should have done that, you know, because the strategic situation was far more important than what the rest of the world thought, you know. The rest of the world has always not been too kind to the United States. You know, we're like the only imperial power that has ever existed in history that cares a lot about whether we're loved or not in the rest of the world. You know, and it's okay to be loved, but the first and most important thing is to be feared and to be able to secure, to demonstrate your power to deter adversaries from starting World War III. Being loved doesn't stop World War III. Being feared and demonstrating strength is what stops World War III. The Kennedy administration was persuaded by the CIA to go forward with the Bay of Pigs operation, which failed catastrophically. This was done, and it failed precisely because of this, because of the political correctness of the time, you know, against the United States appearing in the light of an imperialist power by using its military force the way we had so aggressively in World War II. Interestingly, you know, nobody, you didn't hear any voices raised during World War II against the United States being extremely assertive and doing everything that was necessary to win that war against the fascist powers. You know, it's probably only because there are so many people in the left, both in America and in Europe, that the sudden concern, this political correctness about not using all your might to stop the spread of communism, but try to do it without appearing like an imperialist power. This argument was nowhere in evidence during World War II. You know, only came onto the scene with the Cold War when the adversary was from the left, was with the communists. And I suspect it's because there were so many sympathizers to that ideological point of view, even in our own State Department, but also in academia and the press. So we followed their advice, and it was a disaster. You know, the Bay of Pigs blew up on our face. Kennedy almost abolished the CIA because the Bay of Pigs failed, you know, so catastrophically. It also provided the Soviet Union with an excuse to move missiles into Cuba, medium-range ballistic missiles and intermediate-range ballistic missiles. And that was an excuse because their real object 59 years ago, you know, to move those missiles into Cuba was to improve their nuclear posture so they could launch a surprise nuclear attack against the U.S. mainland with very short warning. You know, when you're launching from Cuba, you don't have to go over the North Pole. Have I lost you? Are you still
there? No, we're still here. Okay, no, good. Cuba is so close. I mean, we probably...
90 miles.
Yeah. Not much time to react.
No time to react. And so that was unacceptable to the Kennedy administration, the Pentagon. You know, there were great arguments about what to do about it. You know, the Pentagon wanted to launch a preemptive strike. The decision was made to exercise a quarantine. You know, I remember being on, I was in elementary school, and I remember this thing. I remember the bus driver had a transistor radio, and everybody knew what was going on. Even the school kids knew that we were on the brink of a nuclear war. And the bus driver turned on his transistor radio so we could hear Kennedy's famous speech, you know, about explaining, you know, how we had entered into this confrontation with the Soviet Union over Cuba, and if necessary, we were going to go to nuclear war over it. You know, these were, so the whole world was holding its breath. All eyes were on this, and we have already given the background about how important, you know, the ideological struggle was. Who was the future? Was it the United States and free enterprise and free political systems? Or was it totalitarian communism, you know, with a state, with state-run economies and not a free political system, a system dominated by communism, which claimed to be, you know, the wave of the future.
It was kind of a shock, I think, that Castro turned to the communists after he took power. I think we thought that he was going to have a democratic society, didn't we?
Some people did. Many, I'd say most did not, and realized that he was a committed communist, and the people surrounding him were also communists. There has been a lot of historical disinformation built up by American academia and the left, you know, to try to whitewash Castro's reputation, you know, especially during the Cold War era. Today, and now that the Soviet Union was gone, it's sort of like, it's hard to find anybody who was sympathetic to the communist system and who defended Castro, defended Soviet communism. Even Bernie Sanders would not do that today, even though during the Cold War, he was so in love with the Soviet system that he took his wife on a honeymoon to the USSR.
Right.
You know, it reminds me a lot of the attitudes toward Nazi Germany and France after the defeat of Nazi Germany. Many of the French were collaborators and did think that Nazism was the wave of the future. But you can't find any Frenchman today, who would say, yeah, I was one of those, or my relatives supported the Vichy government, and we really thought that Hitler's Germany was the wave of the future. Suddenly all these voices disappear. But at the time, these people were much in evidence. The point is that this seemed to be the moment. Everybody had been holding their breath. Was there going to finally be a nuclear war to settle the question about the future? Was it going to be communism or the free world? Will it be settled by the force of arms, by nuclear arms? So for the Soviet Union to have backed off, to have agreed to have to back it and to resolve and remove the missiles from Cuba, was an enormous victory for Kennedy and for the free world. I think it astonished the world, because it meant that the Soviets had failed and they were humiliated. They were humiliated. And it did raise questions about, are they really the wave of the future, even among many of their allies and supporters? Because this seemed a huge contradiction. But people forget. I'm sure if this anniversary is celebrated and mentioned on CNN and MSNBC, as it likely will be, because it's one of the, as I say, it's one of the proudest moments with the Democrat Party, one of the great victories that they can point to. It's going to be all about Camelot and John F. Kennedy, and the focus will be on on profiles and courage, as if it was all a question of his personality and character and courage, when the most important factors in the Soviet Union backing off, they don't want to talk about the 5-to-1 advantage in ICBMs that had been built up by the Kennedy administration and before him by the Eisenhower administration. But Kennedy, deserved credit for that, mostly. And the strategic bomber force, they don't like to talk about that because that doesn't fit into any of the Democrat Party's agenda today, where they're all for nuclear disarmament, even in the face of the buildup by China that I was talking about before. Now, there's one last factor I want to talk about in terms of the Cuban Missile Crisis that's kind of relevant, is relevant. America's need to expel communists from Cuba, the ideological and geostrategic need to do that. Obviously, it was the nuclear missiles were an existential threat, and so we had a high priority. We would have had to have gone to war. We couldn't have accepted that, but fortunately, we won that. But aside from that, Cuba didn't really pose an existential threat to us. And so we were able to tolerate Cuba. And even so, we had made an attempt to invade the country and overthrow it. But the situation with Taiwan and China is different. China has a much stronger commitment. You might call it a need if it someday does not take Taiwan, and perhaps someday soon, that constitutes an existential threat to China, at least in the eyes of the government in Beijing. And why is that? Here's where there's some significant differences between the situation between Cuba and Taiwan. the government of Taiwan, many Americans have forgotten, is called the Republic of China. The Republic of China. You know, and that is because they are the descendants of the Chinese nationalists who fought against communism up until 1949. You know, there was a great civil war. Millions of people died in China. A struggle between the nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek and the communists under Mao Zedong. And this, the 1949 was called the Year of Shock for the United States, because most people in the West were convinced that the nationalists were going to win and that we weren't going to have to face a communist China in the future. But the nationalists lost. And what was left of the nationalist forces, they retreated to the island of Taiwan, sort of a Chinese Dunkirk. And Taiwan became their island fortress. And from the perspective of Beijing, you know, the people that Taiwan, they regard as part of their territory. They regard Taiwan as part of communist China's territory, which is illegally occupied by this rebellious, by these rebels, the Republic of China, you know, who they regard as a threat to their existence. Mm-hmm. They fear that someday that the Republic of China might be able to convince the United States and other allies to invade China and take China back, or to foment revolution on the Chinese mainland and overthrow the Chinese communist government. And let's face it, I mean, the Republic of China, you know, they see themselves as a government in exile. If they could foment revolution in China and get China overthrown, they would do it. If
sure.
they could persuade yeah. the United States and our allies to support them, they would definitely go in and invade the mainland and overthrow the Chinese government. We didn't face any kind of same kind of a situation with Cuba. You know, our incentives to invade Cuba were not nearly as great as the incentives China has to invade Taiwan. So that's something we need to keep in mind, you know, why the Taiwan crisis keeps popping up and why it's so important. And we must not underestimate China's commitment to make that succeed.
Now,
China's commitment, China's determination to take Taiwan is more than just ideological, by the way. It has profound geostrategic reasons for doing it. And here's at least two. You know, one of them, you know, is China's trying to build a defensive chain of islands in the South China Sea. And it, as you know, as we've talked about on this show before, they claim ownership of the South China Sea. And Taiwan is one of the most important, it is the most important link in the defensive chain. If you look at a map and you look at where Taiwan is relative to the South China Sea and the size of Taiwan relative to all the other islands, I mean, this is an unsinkable aircraft carrier. You know, we know that China is building islands out in the South China Sea out of nothing. It's building islands so that it can have air bases out in the South China Sea, so it can push its defensive perimeter further and further out into the South China Sea and further out into the Pacific, too, when you consider the radius of modern aircraft. When you look at Taiwan and all the air bases, its military facilities, if a military giant like China were able to get hold of Taiwan, it would make China unassailable by our aircraft carrier groups and our Navy.
Well, it would also
come
put
in there only because Taiwan is independent,
right,
and pose a threat to China from that direction. So that would seal, that would protect them, and it would serve as a base for projecting power against us into the Pacific and against our Pacific allies.
Right.
So it's a really important square on the geopolitical chessboard. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's okay.
We have to take a really quick break. We'll come back. Hold, everyone, hold that thought. You're listening to We the People. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Man, I had a dreadful flight. I'm back in the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are. thought that you was free. La 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 la.
A couple of selections from Bernie Sanders, the musical. I couldn't help myself.
So we were talking about the potential increase in strength of China if they were to take over Taiwan and their reach. What about Japan?
First, I'd just like to compliment you on the music selections you have during a break, like back in the USSR. Always so appropriate.
I knew you were laughing. I could hear you laughing in my...
For the topic. Before we move on to Japan, I'd just kind of like to complete my thoughts to sort of put the cherry on top, because I wanted to talk about the single most important factor in terms of China's interest. We had concluded that the fact that Taiwan is this incredibly important square on the geopolitical chessboard in terms of China's ability to protect itself and to project power into Pacific. But the last factor that makes it so important is the symbolic factor, something that I think eclipses Cuba. During the Cold War, during the Cold War crisis we were talking about, because possession of Taiwan basically symbolizes whether or not China controls the future. This at least is what I believe the leadership in Beijing has in their mind and why Taiwan is so important to them. As you know from previous discussions, China is a building empire all over the world with its Belt and Road Initiative, and it has a presence. Not many Americans don't know it, but all over the world, in Europe, in Africa, in South America, in Latin America, China is everywhere, both in terms of economic presence and military presence. And if you are, like the Roman Empire, planning to control the future, looking toward world global domination, it's intolerable that you can't control your own backyard. To them, this is completely unacceptable. And also because they in their perception, the whole world is watching in terms of what can they do about Taiwan. This irritant, this challenge to their own legitimacy. If they can't squash Taiwan, they're never going to have global domination.
Right.
So this is the thing that I think basically makes a war inevitable sooner or later over Taiwan. And it may be a lot sooner than people think. People are thinking that it could come sooner than we have been suspecting already. We're talking about, there have been estimates put out by some members of the Pentagon talking about in 6 years. Others are talking about in 5 years, I think it might be even sooner than that. I wouldn't rule it out as happening even this year. The estimates that are based on 5 or 6 years from now is based on China's sea lift capabilities. The Pentagon's assessment is, they don't have the sea lift capability. They don't have, the Navy is almost there, but they're not quite there to be able to lift enough troops to take over Taiwan. And I think that somebody in the Navy has got to rethink this assumption that invading Taiwan in 2021 is going to be like Operation Tarawa or Operation Iwo Jima in World War II. And that taking an island is all about landing craft and naval capabilities. Have they forgotten that we didn't have to send a single soldier to defeat Japan, the Japanese home islands? We did it from the air. We bombed them into submission. And yes, we used atomic bombs to bomb them into submission. And World War II was ended on the decks of the Missouri without a single American soldier having to have fought and landed on the beaches of the island, home islands of Japan to conquer Japan. Why does the Pentagon and every other analyst in Washington, it seems to me, have forgotten that lesson and thinks that what we need to be doing is counting the number of landing craft and the naval strength that, that China has so that it can reach the Taiwan Strait. They don't need any of that. They can do it all with missiles. And if necessary, I think their commitment to the conquest of Taiwan is so great that they would resort to nuclear missiles. In fact, they have exercised that. They have exercised that. You know, I don't think they'd necessarily, they wouldn't need to obliterate the whole island. You know, I think if they attacked a couple of military centers and wiped them out with tactical nuclear weapons, that escalation would be enough to probably get the Taiwanese to surrender, and it would probably be enough for the United States to seek an exit ramp, because we don't want to have a nuclear war over Taiwan. Well, at least I hope the Biden administration isn't so stupid that they would want to get us into a nuclear war over Taiwan, a nuclear war which we would probably lose. Another factor that didn't exist during the Cuban Missile Crisis and why we would lose this war, is President Kennedy didn't face a coalition of nuclear powers during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He faced the Soviet Union. But we will probably face a coalition of China and Russia and North Korea in a contest over Cuba. As I keep saying on this show and everywhere else, you know, this is the new bloc. They don't always advertise it very publicly because they like strategic surprise. And so they don't hold big conferences. Well, they actually do hold conferences, but they don't make a big deal about it, like in NATO. They even have treaties, but they haven't made a big deal about it. I hope that we ignore the cooperation, the partnership that has grown up, because they would like us to be surprised when push comes to shove, when the war actually comes.
Well, China and Russia have already carried out joint military exercises,
yes,
haven't they?
Major military exercises, yeah, including in Vostok 18, which was one of probably the biggest military exercise in world history. And they even had it was a decade ago, there was even a big strategic forces exercise that was jointly held by Russia and China that involved, guess what? A nuclear war over Taiwan.
Oh, boy.
In my article, I quote, it hasn't gotten enough attention in the mainstream press, so I put it out there a couple of times for people to try to listen. There's a quote-unquote unofficial website of China's People's Liberation Army, you know, where they kind of put out stuff that their foreign ministry doesn't want to talk about publicly. I think they intend for us to see it so that we get the message if we're too stupid to get the message. And I don't blame them for thinking that we're too stupid to get the message. You know, our political leaders and military leaders often seem to ignore the obvious. But on this website, I think we may have talked about this in an earlier show, the website responded to a promise by the Prime Minister in the Defense Ministry, Japan's Defense Ministry, when the United States kind of reminded China that we have an interest in protecting Taiwan. And that's been one of the other dangerous things, you know. The Biden administration has been kind of waffling on whether we would come to Taiwan's defense or not. There's ambiguity there. That's a dangerous thing to do. The ambiguity, well, we'll get into that later. For now, the Biden administration, you know, has spoken up on occasion and indicated to China, try to tell China to back off, that the differences between Taiwan and China should be resolved peacefully. You know, and not and they shouldn't invade Taiwan. And we've sold arms to Taiwan. We've got to, it's come out recently with that we've had technical people on our troops in Taiwan helping train the Taiwanese to use our weapons, you know. So we have been doing things to demonstrate. Now, Japan tried to be a good ally, and they spoke up, and they said that if the United States comes to the defense of Taiwan against China, Japan will be there. You know, we will help the United States defend Taiwan against China. And in response to that, this unofficial PLA website, you know, basically said, you know, if Japan sends even one soldier or one ship to protect Taiwan, you know, from our reconquest, you know, we will annihilate Japan with repeated nuclear strikes. And Russia will join us in striking Japan with nuclear weapons. And North Korea will join us in striking Japan with nuclear weapons. And we will nuclear bomb Japan until they completely surrender the way they did in World War II. And then Russia and China will occupy Japan and break up, you know, the Japanese home islands. They will be occupied by Chinese and Russian military troops.
Wow.
And one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, we've heard nothing from Russia and North Korea. Their foreign ministries have not come out and denied this. You know, and because it's probably true, almost certainly true, you know, that this actually is a description of the post-war settlement that Russia and China and North Korea have in mind. And I would add, not just for Japan, if Japan were to become involved, I think that it would be naive to assume that they would be more merciful to the United States, who is going to be their chief adversary in Taiwan. I think the outcome that they are describing for Japan is what they would also have in mind for the United States. Our destruction and occupation, if we are foolish enough to push it that far. And how can we be saying this, though? I mean, drew the connection. We should need to go back to the numbers. One always has to come back to the numbers when we're talking about these geostrategic and military threats, because it's the numbers that matter. It's your military capabilities that matter. And China knows that, even if the Biden administration doesn't seem to know it. You know, when China finishes deploying the DF-41 ICBMs in these 400 silos and gets itself a force of 4,000 intercontinental ICBM warheads in just a few years, it's expected to happen. It's not over a decade, but just a few years from now. Because they're deploying these things at such a rapid rate, that will give them a 10-to-1 advantage over the United States in ICBM warheads, a 10-to-1 advantage. Don't forget, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had a 5-to-1 advantage over the Soviet Union. And it will give them a nearly 3-to-1 advantage over all of our strategic nuclear weapons, counting all of them on bombers, on submarines, and on ICBMs.
Holy cow.
With the DF-41 alone in those 400 silos, a 3-to-1 advantage in overall nuclear power. That doesn't count all the other nuclear weapons that China
has. Dr. Pry, we're going to come back with you next hour. We're going to hold you hostage in Florida for one more hour and finish this topic, if you can possibly think of finishing this topic. Big topic. Anyway, I found another song from Bernie Sanders' honeymoon reel, so I thought we'd close out the hour with that. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
That dancing girl is making eyes at me. I'm sure she's working for the KGB in this paradise.